Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Today, Parkland, Florida marks the one-year anniversary of the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. 17 people were killed that day. A wave of activism followed, with Parkland students leading the call for never again. But in the year that followed, almost 1,200 young people were killed by gun violence, murdered, or died in accidental shootings, or caught in the crossfire. That number, almost 1,200, does not include young people who took their own lives with a gun. A special project of national and local reporters sought to find out why these kids died, what it says about America and guns, and to tell their stories. This hour on Point, since Parkland, almost 1,200 kids in 12 months cut down by gun violence. And you can join us. What are you thinking about a year since the Parkland shootings? Do you know a young person who was killed by gun violence in the past 12 months? When you hear, and you will, about how some of these 1,200 kids died, some at home, some just hanging out on the street, how can we find a way forward to protect young people at a time when the politics around guns seem as polarized as ever? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we'll start today in Parkland, Florida, with Katie Switalski, Broward County reporter for NPR affiliate WLRN in Miami. Katie, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
So first of all, tell us, how is this day being marked in Parkland, Florida?
Well, Broward County Public Schools are hosting a day of service, and particularly at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, it's a half day that's optional for service. So students that do come to school are doing things like serving first responders breakfast and volunteer projects. But it is entirely optional today and tomorrow, and a lot of families are choosing to keep their kids home and stay home together, almost hunkering down.
And I understand there's going to be a moment of silence today as well?
Yes, there will be a countywide moment of silence at 10:17 in just a few minutes. But there's also going to be another one in the afternoon for the city. And, tonight they're marking it with an interfaith vigil in one of the central parks of Parkland, Pine Trails Park.
Okay. I imagine that students and families from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School have been, in a sense, very, dreading this anniversary because it's an anniversary of a tragedy. Have you been able to, you and your colleagues there, to talk to some of them? How are they feeling about this day?
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard to put into words because it is an impossibly hard day that just culminates what has been the most difficult year this community has seen. And it's hard to show how difficult it really is for people here to deal with. But, mental health resources are still very much needed a year later. Trauma, PTSD, healing, and coping are the main focuses of this community right now. And they're doing it in all different ways, whether it's through continued activism or it's through quiet reflection and a community that's really been trying to come together in the face of a lot of division over the past year. It's incredibly difficult.
Well, so Katie, let me ask you a little bit more about that, because this was, such a high-profile tragedy, and because of the way many of the students, responded and the passion with which they responded thereafter, they've been in the public eye for a year. I mean, has the community itself really had a chance to mourn the reality of what happened that day a year ago?
I think the answer to that is yes and no, but that is really the main focus of today. And I think any public official and anyone from the city will tell you that today is for exactly that, to be by themselves and mourn their loss and remember, all of the great memories and the great parts about these 17 people that are no longer a part of this community. And so, being thrown into the spotlight with a lot of the March for Our Lives activism, some of these students have become celebrities when they didn't plan to become celebrities. And so I think they're taking their own time today. And over the past year, they've found different ways to, whether it's through online schooling or scaling back or trying activism in a quieter way, they're finding what works for them, and it's taken a year to do it.
Yeah. Now, of course, they're just like in the rest of the country, there's no sort of monolithic or unified view about guns in Parkland itself. So, you know, finally, Katie, I'm just wondering if you could just give us some insight or some thoughts about how, you know, a year later, the issue of guns or what should be done about gun violence in America, how that's sort of the different views on that and how that's playing out in Parkland.
Absolutely. I mean, the gun culture in Parkland is much like the rest of America. It's really split here. I think a lot of people would assume because we are the epicenter for March for Our Lives and this gun control movement that the city would be unified on this issue, and that's not the case at all. There's plenty of residents here, and part of the split, I will say, that is formed between, you know, families of victims is that there's the pro-gun and pro-gun control groups. So that has come out a lot in our Florida policy. It's come out a lot in any of the recommendations in the year since the tragedy, what's moving through our legislature right now. It's focused on school hardening and school security, and that is disappointing to gun control advocates. And, you know, with an area that is so split like Parkland, we're 50-50 in the politics. I mean, in a Democratic county, half of the people here are registered Republican, half are registered Democrats. The culture surrounding guns is not easy to talk about at all. It's become a very delicate subject.
Well, Katie Switalski, Broward County reporter for WLRN in Miami, speaking to us today from Parkland, Florida. Katie, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
All right. Well, it has been a year since the Parkland shooting. And that phrase, since Parkland, is the title or the headline of a special project by the Miami Herald and The Trace, which is a not-for-profit journalism organization that focuses on gun violence in America. And since Parkland, this special project has taken a look at all of the children, at least as many of the children, young people who have been killed by gun violence in the past 12 months. They found almost 1,200 American kids shot and killed, and they tell their stories in this special project. And joining us now is Caitlin Ostroff, data reporter for the Miami Herald and the McClatchy News Group. She led this effort to gather data on youth gun shootings in the past year. Caitlin Ostroff, welcome to you.
Thanks, Magna.
Also with us is Akoto Ofori Atta, managing editor at The Trace, the online news organization covering gun violence in America. Akoto, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So this is, since Parkland is an amazing project, and a little bit later I'm going to talk with you both about sort of how it came about. But first of all, Caitlin, how did you get this number of almost 1,200 American kids, young people, shot and killed in gun violence in the past 12 months?
Yeah, so The Trace had started compiling this information. There's a nonprofit research group called Gun Violence Archive, and they basically take news articles and they start compiling this information of all people who have been shot or killed at any point in time. They've been doing it since at least 2014 is where we got data going back through. And so The Trace started compiling that, and we started sharing this information between the two news organizations. And we went through at the Herald and said, okay, let's start filling in gaps where we can, because sometimes, you know, the name of the victim isn't initially known. Maybe the age is a little bit off. And so we started going through and saying, where can we get police reports for this? Where can we confirm this information? Where can we get more? And what can we pull out of this information in terms of, you know, the methods in which these happen and why they happen? Because one of the things that we went into this knowing was there really isn't a lot of federally funded gun research. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to see what insight we could get from this data of 1 year in the aftermath since Parkland.
Right. So Akoto, then, I mean, tell us, you know, what are some of the insights, maybe the top insight that after looking at all of these cases that you came away with?
So at The Trace, this is something we have been reporting on a lot. And one of the big takeaways is that, you know, school shootings account for a very, very small percentage mm-hmm. of gun deaths among young people. In our set, less than 1% of the victims were killed in a school shooting. The other big takeaway is that, you know, kids in this country are getting caught in the crosshairs of their, you know, guardian, their parents and guardians' domestic disputes and losing their lives in domestic violence situations. Many, many kids are gaining access to unsecured weapons and killing themselves that way. Quite often, kids are killing other kids with unsecured weapons mm-hmm. accidentally. And then, of course, we have, you know, the gun violence that plagues neighborhoods and cities across the country, like Miami and St. Louis and Chicago and Detroit, in which, you know, which ensnares many young Black men and boys of color.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about that, because I mean, when you looked at the numbers and the cases, I don't want to call them numbers. Mm-hmm. These are people, right? That mm-hmm. that one of the other clear conclusions that the project emerges with is that perhaps what we're not talking about enough is how the primary victims of gun violence, or the majority of the victims of gun violence, are young people of color.
Yes, right. And, you know, it works out to about nearly 3 gun violence, young gun violence victims a day since Parkland. And yes, the large majority of gun violence victims of homicides are young Black men. You know, it's an issue of how guns get into the streets of these neighborhoods. And, you know, people sort of misidentify this violence as gang violence, but that's not entirely accurate. Quite often it's just small interpersonal disputes that escalate and turn deadly, because many young people living in these neighborhoods have access to illegal weapons.
Mm. Well, we're going to take a quick break here and talk about a lot more when we come back. We're talking about what has happened since Parkland for the past year, for the past 12 months. There's a special project between the Miami Herald and The Trace where they cataloged almost 1,200, almost 1,200 young people in America cut down by gun violence, and what their stories tells us about why children remain uniquely vulnerable to gun violence in America. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what has happened to young people in the year since the Parkland school shooting. That was a year ago today. There's been a special project undertaken by the Miami Herald and The Trace. It's called Since Parkland. And they scoured the nation to find out who were the victims of gun violence, the young victims of gun violence in the past 12 months. And they found nearly 1,200 young lives snuffed out, that they're all cataloged in a special project called Since Parkland. And here's a way that they describe sort of the scale of the number of young people who've been killed by gun violence in the past 12 years. They say, we found nearly 1,200 lives snuffed out. That's a Parkland every 5 days, enough victims to fill 3 ultra-wide Boeing 777s. The true number is certainly higher because no government agency keeps a real-time tally and funding for research is restricted by law. I'm joined today by Caitlin Ostroff. She's data reporter for the Miami Herald and the McClatchy News Group. She led this special effort. Okoto Ofori-Atta also joins us. Okoto is managing editor at The Trace. And I would also like to now introduce into the program Ajene McGee. Ajene joins us from Detroit. She's a student at Annapolis High School in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. She is editorial editor for the school's newspaper, the Cougar Crier, and one of the many young journalists that this special project reached out to write the obituaries of these almost 1,200 young people who've been killed by gun violence. Ajane, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So first of all, Ajane, tell me, when the Miami Herald and the Trace reached out to you and said, would you be part of this project, what did you think?
At first, I was a bit nervous because while I had written before and I had journalist experience, I'd never written about something of this magnitude. I didn't think that I'd be able to do any of the victims justice because I wasn't really aware of what I was getting into. But the Trace and my editors were really supportive. They helped me with my guidelines, and mm-hmm. I realized that it is something that teen reporters, we like can share and we have a voice about. And I realized that I wanted to be a part of the project.
Yeah. I mean, so you're writing about people who are essentially your peers. They were young members of your very own community. You ended up writing 19 of these obituaries. Can you talk about one or two of them that particularly stayed with you?
Yes. So back in November, I believe, I wrote an obituary on Najee R. Murray. Mm-hmm. She was a student at Bradley University in Illinois, and she was shot at a party that her university was, off the campus of her university. The reason she stuck with me is because when I was researching about her, I saw a lot of parallels between her and myself. So, we were both young Black women. Both had been accepted to Ivy League universities. She got accepted into Brown. The only reason she didn't go to Brown is because she wanted to stay in state and closer to her family. I found out recently that I'd been accepted to Princeton. We're both the oldest of three, and we would babysit our younger siblings. I babysit my younger siblings every day. Mm-hmm. And we both listen to the same kinds of music. So when I was reporting about her, I just saw so many parallels to my own life, and it made me realize just how widespread this issue is and how it can affect anyone.
Yeah. And how did Najee die?
A shooter opened fire at the party, and she was one of the victims caught in the crossfire.
Yeah. So, Ajane, hang on here for just a second. Akota, let me turn back to you. Can you tell us a little bit more about what reaching out to these young journalists to write these almost 1,200 obituaries, what that brought to the project that you otherwise might not have had?
Sure. So, you know, I think young people living in America today have to deal with gun violence in a way that folks like me did not. I graduated from high school in 2001, 2 years after Columbine. I had not ever had to experience a lockdown. And there are many students across the country, some of whom wrote for this project, who live in cities that require them to make decisions about their safety every single day, hour to hour, moment to moment. So, we felt like if the gun violence conversation is now centering around these young voices, the conversation also needed their perspective and needed their reporting. And what they brought to the project was, you know, the full scope of their experiences with having to think about gun violence all the time. Mm-hmm. And it allows for a richness and a complexity that I think we couldn't have gotten otherwise.
Yeah. Caitlin Ostroff, just the same question to you. What do you think that these young people brought to the project?
I think it's a different perspective that as people who are not in school anymore, Akoto and I can't really share because they are the ones who are still dealing with the, you know, mm-hmm. school shooting mentality that we all now are in of wondering, you know, could it happen here? And expanding that out and showing them and others that it happens not just on school grounds, but in the surrounding areas they live in, it really makes them and others think about the scope of gun violence outside of just school shootings and really gives their voice to the issue and shows, you know, they're not just affected by school shootings. This affects them outside of school as well. And it's a number that isn't really changing. And so unless people choose to acknowledge it, it's not going to change.
Yeah. So one of the things to me that emerges as such a strong lesson when looking at the stories of these almost 1,200 young people is that when we look at where and how children are being killed by gun violence, we see where the sort of where the holes are, the vulnerabilities are regarding gun policy and gun laws in America. Okoto, I'm thinking, you know, for example, the story that was written about how children often are victims of gun violence in what are domestic violence situations, right? Like the incredible story of Amanda Simpson and what happened to her family. Could you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yes, I think you're right that there are a lot of loopholes that allow people who should not have access to weapons, primarily men who have been convicted of domestic violence. Yeah. And that story was actually produced in the Miami Herald's newsroom based off the data. And it is a real tragedy.
Yeah.
One woman, you know, lost three of her kids, her ex killed.
Yeah, well, let me just jump
kids.
In here. I'm going to help you out because I actually have the story right in front of me.
Okay.
I take your point that it came out of the Miami Herald's newsroom. But this is the story of Amanda Simpson, whose husband at a particular point in time had threatened to kill himself, to take his own life with a gun. He was later voluntarily institutionalized. His gun was taken away from him. But then, for certain reasons, returned back to him. And a year later, when Amanda Simpson was trying to get her life back on track, she was in a new relationship. Her husband showed up in her home or where she was and shot their three children, her boyfriend and her as well, and then proceeded to kill himself. So, Caitlin, the
right.
question
she
is,
survived.
She survived. That's right. So, Caitlin, the question is here, like, so how, you know, is this an area of gun regulation where because there's so much gray area and a patchwork of rules here about, you know, at what point in time should a weapon be taken away from someone that children can be particularly vulnerable?
Right. And we've seen some action on that front at state levels in the year since Parkland in 2018. There were several states that passed protection orders, extreme risk protection orders, to keep guns away from people who have been shown that they might be a threat to themselves or others. Most of the conversation about gun legislation is happening at a state level. And so, there are instances that we found that, you know, with those types of protections, maybe some of these might have been preventable. A lot of the domestic situations were unfortunately murder-suicides, most of them were. And so it's really heartbreaking to read those reports. And I actually worked with Alex Harris, who reported that story, and looking at the reports that we got back were just absolutely heartbreaking. And so I think, you know, that part of the conversation that needs to be had is, you know, the domestic situations, are there ways to prevent them? And how should states go about that?
Mm. Well, let's go to the phones here briefly. Let's go to Phil, who's calling from Eagle Grove, Iowa. Phil, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. You know, I don't think that anything's ever going to be done about gun violence and taking guns off the street until it affects the people on Capitol Hill personally. You know, a politician was broached with that subject some time ago, and he said, well, it did affect us personally. Gabby Giffords got shot.
Steve,
well, it was true that Gabby Giffords got shot, but Gabby Giffords wasn't his daughter. It wasn't her, you know, it wasn't his son. You know, when your neighbor gets shot, you feel bad. You feel bad. But when your child gets shot, you want every gun removed from a 100-mile radius.
Mm.
You know, so until it affects the people who make the laws, until it affects them personally, I don't think anything will ever be done. There's just too much money involved.
Right. Well, Phil, thank you so much for your call. I'd also point out that Representative Steve Scalise obviously was also a victim of gun violence, having been shot at that congressional softball game. But Ajahnay McGee, let me turn back to you here. I mean, you're the young person at the table. What's your response to what the caller said that he feels so, it seems, cynical and jaded about what politicians may or may not do regarding gun violence, that he says they just won't care until something truly terrible happens to them. What do you think about that?
I think he proposed a valid argument. I think that that's an issue that can have go in multiple different ways. I think there are politicians who there are politicians who will like staunchly, like even if it hasn't personally affected them, they will try their hardest to impose more gun regulations. And then I think there are politicians that will do the exact opposite. But I think that at the end of the day, like their course of action will depend on like how much they know. And I think that projects like Students Parkland will bring them more awareness about how children are affected by these issues, and that'll allow them to take a more developed course of action.
Just add to that, to underscore Ajane's point, is that one of the things we kept hearing from student journalists over the last year is that, you know, the politics behind this is messy and complicated, and the stories mm-hmm. are important. Understanding, you know, who these kids were. I mean, it's one thing to, yes, it's the number is nearly 1,200, but if you go on our site on sinceparkland.org, you can see what that actually means, right? So we lost, you know, over 300 siblings, people who have younger and older brothers and sisters who are no longer here. We lost athletes, musicians, dancers, infants and toddlers, many 18-year-olds who had just become young parents themselves. And these are the things that, you know, sort of help you to understand in color, give some context to the debate. And while the politics can sort of whirl around us, centering, you know, and understanding the human cost of it all, I think is really important. And that's what students like Ajane really were committed to in this project.
Yeah. Well, I want to actually play a little bit of tape here from the project, because you also have these video interviews with some parents and family members of these young people who have been killed in the past year. One of them is 14-year-old Christian Robinson. Christian was killed as he sat in the backseat of a friend's car during a road rage incident. Now, this shooting came just 3 hours on the same day as the Parkland shooting on February 14th of last year. Now, Christian's mother, Tanya Robinson, spoke to the Miami Herald McClatchy After Parkland, or Since Parkland Project, about what happened to her son.
It's very extremely hard because Christian was a protector and he was the closest to me out of my kids. And he's just gone. He never got a chance to experience everything he wanted to. Guns are not an answer. Even if you're angry or mad, like you're taking somebody's world away from them.
That's Tanya Robinson, mother of 14-year-old Christian Robinson, who was killed a year ago today. Ajane McGee, let me turn back to you here, because another one of the 19 obituaries that you wrote for this project was for Christian Miller, a 3-year-old who was also killed in a drive-by shooting. Can you tell us about Christian Miller?
Yes. So on January 24th, Christian was in the car with his godmother and his godbrother. She was taking them to see Sesame Street Live. He was a big fan of Sesame Street. And while they were driving on the South Field Freeway, another car pulled up beside them and started firing shots into the car. One of them hit Christian, and his godmother pulled off of the South Road freeway into the nearest BP gas station crying for help, and he was rushed to the emergency room at Children's Hospital, but his injuries were deemed fatal, and he died shortly after.
How close to where you live did this happen?
Yes. So I live about 5 minutes away from the Southfield Freeway. I use it every day to get to and from school. I'm very familiar with the area in which he was shot. So when I heard about this story, it really struck me personally. he was going to see Sesame Street Live at the Fox Theater. That's a big rite of passage for the children, at least in my family. I've been to the Fox multiple times, and it was just heartbreaking to me that he was deprived of not only that opportunity, but the opportunity to live his full life.
I wonder, Ajnay, do you think that that adults across the country who maybe don't live in places where the impact of gun violence is so near, that they fully understand or realize how close these issues are to the lives of, you know, young people like you, who in the not far from your own neighborhood, these things are happening?
They may and they may not. I guess it depends on where their priorities are. Even if they don't live in places that are affected by gun violence, like there are many like teen reporters like myself who live in areas that aren't directly affected by gun violence, but they do not realize that it is an issue in America, and they are proactive in their research and understanding of the subject. So I believe that if they do have that interest and they do recognize that this is an issue and they try to make themselves aware, then it doesn't matter where they are.
Well, Ajnay McGee and Akoto Ofori-Atta and Caitlin Ostroff, stand by for just a second. We're talking about this special project called Since Parkland, a special project that catalogs the almost 1,200 young people who have been killed by gun violence in the year since the Parkland school shooting a year ago today. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Ali Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what has happened in America since Parkland, since the Parkland school shooting a year ago today. Since Parkland is the title of a special project between The Trace, an online news organization covering gun violence in America, between the Miami Herald and the McClatchy News Group, where they cataloged the almost 1,200 young people who have been killed in America due to gun violence in the past 12 years. Let's listen to some tape here. This is Rondine Taylor. Her son, Jeremiah Stewart, was 16 when he was fatally shot last June in Kansas City, one of more than 50 young people who have died due to gun violence in the Kansas City area since 2016. And Rondine Taylor told the Kansas City Star that she thinks government does need to take the lead to solve the growing problem of gun violence. You'll hear her mention 164 homicides, and that's a figure where she includes both adults and children.
Guns are too easy to get a hold of. I just feel like people just need to speak up. There's too many of our kids getting killed in the streets, and it just seems like it's happening more and more. How you have 164 homicides in 1 year? That's kind of a lot. How much more does it have to take in order for government, mayor, or somebody to do something about it?
It's Rondine Taylor. Her son Jeremiah was 16 when he was shot last year. You know, we're getting comments here online. A listener on Twitter calling themselves Deplorable Frank takes a different view. Frank says, why discuss the problem as a gun control problem while never looking at a societal mental health, marijuana, or even bullying problem? A gun does not make anyone violent. They were that way before ever acquiring a firearm. Let's go back to the callers. Let's go to David, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'm a liberal gun owner, and I want to say, unlike the NRA, I would support any, you know, reasonable legislation that helps keep guns out of the hands of the wrong people. And I would grudgingly accept, you know, restrictions on magazine capacity, because clearly that has an effect on the body count in the case of a mass shooting. But an assault weapon ban is meaningless. I mean, because, you know, the other aspects of an assault weapon, like folding stock, pistol grip, you know, bayonet lug, they have no effect on the lethality. I mean, it's just ergonomics. So, you know, you can still have your, the assault aspect of it is just extra trouble.
Yeah.
Again, you know, and it's going to get the gun owners upset, and really it doesn't have any effect.
Right. Well, so David, can I just jump in here for a second? So I hear you about your views on assault weapon bans, but, you know, one of the things that this special project, the Since Parkland project, really highlighted is, for example, an entirely different class of deaths for young people, you know, kids who died because they got a hold of a weapon in their house and accidentally shot it and either killed a friend or themselves. So what about the idea of sort of trigger safeties, for example?
Well, sure.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, keeping them locked up, you're supposed to keep them locked up in a safe unless it's ready for use, like you want by your bedside or something. In that case, they have these little safes that are right next to your bed, and you can open them up really quickly with a numerical combination.
Right. Well, David.
Yeah, sure. I'm all for safety.
Okay.
Aspect.
Well, David, thank you for your call. Caitlin Ostroff, let me turn back to you there. So, David is in support of those rules, but there's a real patchwork, though, across the United States in terms of the rules surrounding how guns need to be stored in the home, right?
Yeah. So, it depends state by state as to whether it is illegal to leave a firearm unsecure. Different states will sometimes charge the parents if a child commits an accidental shooting because a gun was left unsecured in their reach. And then there's also, I wanted to touch on the topic of, you know, we did hear from people as we reported this project who said, you know, I don't think the issue is the guns themselves. It is the people who choose to reach for them in a moment of anger. Christian Robinson's mom felt that way, where she's not necessarily against guns, but she wishes that the person who had reached for one when he was angry that the car Christian was inside of cut him off, that he hadn't had access to it. And so I think the debate kind of gets pulled into all of these different directions, but not everyone that we spoke with was, you know, complete proponents of extreme gun control. It was they want responsible gun ownership, and they want people to really be using them for safety, for their safety, for the safety of others, and not as an instrument to harm others without cause.
Right. Akota, was
right.
that? I heard
Magna,
you there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that because my colleagues at The Trace actually put together for this package a piece that explains some of the solutions and the things and the sort of things we know work. And I encourage everybody to check that out. But one of the things that does seem to have the most effectiveness is safe storage laws and requiring people to lock up their weapons. And then to Caitlin's point, holding adults accountable when kids do get a hold of these weapons and injure themselves or someone else is something that also seems to be effective. So, you know, there are some of these things would be classified as, you know, common sense legislation that, you know, seem to be effective.
Yeah. So I want to talk with all of you a little bit about what has changed or not changed in terms of, you know, overall views and attitudes, you know, along the lines we're just talking about what could or should be done about this overall challenge that we face in this country. Because, you know, I'm seeing here that, for example, in the year since the Parkland shootings, the March for Our Lives movement is credited with helping to lead some 67 new gun control laws in 2018. That was more than triple the number enacted in 2017. But there's also this new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll just out that finds that in the immediate aftermath of what happened in Parkland, there were 71% of Americans at that time a year ago who said that laws or covering firearm sales should be stricter. But now, a year later, it's 51%. And if you look at, if you parse the data more deeply, you find that actually over the past several decades, attitudes about laws around guns have actually been pretty consistent in this country. So Akota, what does that tell us about, you know, what people think about how this problem should be addressed?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the issue is divisive and continues to be divisive. And it's tough to say. I mean, no one can say for sure, you know, what the best way is to go about addressing this crisis. The Trace, what we do, and also at the Herald, is really sort of, you know, lay the groundwork with the facts. There's a lot of misinformation and politicalization of things that things that just need to be corrected on the record. And, you know, what we know is that kids are getting killed in this crisis in many different ways, and that that would be the starting point. Understanding those ways would be the starting point to really addressing those issues.
Yeah, this poll is actually, this NPR poll is really interesting. They have a data set that shows that, what, back in the early 90s, almost 80% of Americans at that time said gun laws should be more strict. And now, in 2018, they find in terms of the people who believe gun laws should be more strict, that number is down to 51%. But let's go back to the callers. Let's go to Carl, who's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air.
You know, this is a great conversation we're having, and we should always have these. But there's two things that needs to happen before anything ever happened with gun violence and gun control in our country. Number one, Republicans have to get out of the pocket of the NRA. And before you say, well, Carl, that's politically hard, I will respond to you, do you remember President Al Gore? No, you don't, because he lost, partly because he lost Tennessee, because he had the nerve to stand up against the NRA. And ever since then, the Democratic Party has stood up against the NRA and have pretty much rid themselves with that plague. Now they're free to do sensible legislation. And if the Republican ever follows that lead, then we can get something done. Number two, we need to stop sanitizing what guns and bullets do to the human body. We need to show that kid, that 16-year-old kid in St. Louis or Chicago, dead on the side of the street with half his head blown off. We need to show what horrific trauma bullets do to children's bodies in rural Kentucky when someone commit murder suicide. And if, and unless we start doing those two things, we would be running around chasing our tails, and we'd be working around the edges of the problem, this plague in America.
Well, Carl, thank you so much for your call. Koto, is that you? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think, you know, going back to your earlier point before the caller made his comment about attitudes. You know, the NRA has really done a really effective job in peddling the idea of fear and using and needing guns as a means for self-defense. 30 years ago, the number one reason why people owned weapons was because of sportsmanship. And now the number one reason is because of self-defense. And that's largely because of the NRA's machine of peddling fear and telling people that they need to be protecting themselves against forces that aren't actually real threats.
Okay. Well, let's go back to Mary, who's calling from Harrodsburg, Kentucky. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a point about the responsibility that goes with owning a handgun. I'm a retired emergency room nurse. I worked 5 years in Eastern Oregon. In 1 year, we had four children under the age of 18 killed. In every instance, the handgun or rifle was unsecured. And all of these were unintentional injuries.
Oh.
So I think when someone is going to buy a gun, they need to go through a gun safety class, they need to be registered, and they need to understand the absolute responsibility going with it.
Okay. Well, Mary, thank you for your call. Let's get another one in here. Let's go to Bill, who's calling from New Orleans. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I think the first step in taking care of this issue is turning it from an opinion confrontation to a data issue. We need to fund studies on gun violence and gun deaths. You know, the gun lobby is fighting those studies and making them very difficult. But I think that's the first step, to be able to say, you know, here's the data.
Right. Well, Bill, thank you so much for your call. Caitlin Ostroff, let me turn back to you on that, because you actually did mention that at the top of the hour, that at the federal level, there has been some reduction or curtailing of data gathering or studies about gun violence as a public health issue in America. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So in the mid-90s, there was an amendment passed called the Dickey Amendment, which basically just had a chilling effect over federal funding of gun research since then. And so because of that, it's really hard for academics and health professionals to get funding to study some of the causes and potential responses to curtailing gun violence. And so one of the things that we talked with doctors about, particularly at UF Health in Jacksonville, was they started doing unfunded research because they needed answers to the questions of where are these shooting victims coming from and how can we help prevent them from being taken to the level one trauma center and what can we do to prevent that. And they weren't able to get any funding for that, and so they did it in spite of it. But you don't often have people who are able to do that. And until you understand information about why a problem is happening, you can't address methods to prevent it and treat it. And so one of the things that we really drilled into in our main story was the fact that the lack of federally funded research means that we have less information to work with to try and figure out ways to prevent some of these deaths and shootings.
Right. Well, I mean, that's partially because the NRA has seen that research as they believe it's to be used for gun control laws rather than for the betterment of the public health.
I mean, the NRA has, they said in a statement to us that they aren't against research to look at ways to prevent injuries. But, you know, it has been one of the, they were supporters of the Dickey Amendment, and that has been one of the chilling effects of the legislation.
Yeah. Well, Ajahnay McGee, let me turn back to you here. We got just a couple minutes left in this conversation. I'm wondering, I mean, you're a student at Annapolis High School in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. You know, you've got the rest of your life ahead of you, and it sounds like you're really going places, Ajahnay. But I'm wondering, how has being part of this project, has it changed your view of what you want your view on guns in America? I mean, what do you want for your future and for the people of your generation in terms of how this nation deals with the issue of guns?
Yes. So when I first began the project, I think that I had a rather skewed idea of what gun violence was, because growing up in Detroit, I'd seen gun violence as only drive-by shootings or things in relation to other crimes, whether that'd been theft or anything drug-related. So that's what I thought gun violence was. But the more stories that I researched and the more obituaries that I wrote, I realized that it's such an expansive idea. I've written stories about instances where children have accidentally killed one another due to a gun being unsecured. I've written about domestic issues where parents have shot their children. So I think what I want for myself and for my peers is to recognize that it isn't gun violence isn't limited to what they may think, what they may see on the local news. Gun violence can happen in the home. Gun violence can happen just about anywhere. And it isn't, it doesn't have to be as polarizing as they thought.
Well, Ajahnay McGee, a student at Annapolis High School in Dearborn Heights, Michigan, and editorial editor for the school's paper, The Cougar Crier, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Akoto Foriata, with managing editor at The Trace, thank you.
Thank you.
And Caitlin Ostroff, data reporter at the Miami Herald. Thank you so much, Caitlin.
Thank you so much.
And folks, if you go to onpointradio.org, you'll find a link there to the Beyond or the Since Parkland project. And also you'll find a special essay that McClatchy's East Asian editor, Kristen Roberts, wrote for us about why this project highlights the importance of national organizations working with local reporters on the ground to really get a sense of what's happening in your neighborhoods with gun violence. So go to onpointradio.org to read that special essay. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Thank you. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.